As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
You're listening to Why Always Us, a Manchester City podcast from The Athletic. I'm David Mooney. Sam Lee is with me. Hi, Sam.
Yeah, hello.
How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm all right. And I feel good that there'll be a podcast that people can listen to and won't think, what a miserable sod, or what a pair of miserable sods.
I don't think they ever think that of you, really.
Do you think?
I think I have the personality of someone who is, oh God, he's a dour City fan. I get that. I understand if people think that. But you, I always think you're quite sunny side sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah. But not in recent weeks. But I enjoyed the game. So yeah, let's go on with the quiz.
Right. Well, right now we're offering you the opportunity to subscribe to The Athletic for just £1 a month. You can enjoy all of our great articles on City and so much more. Sam, what's on the horizon for you right now with City?
There's like a big thing on the CFG that we're going to start working on, but that won't be for a while. You know, that's like a huge elephant. You need to eat that in little bits. I'm not actually sure what's coming next week. There's the Porto game. Champions League with City is always like a kind of challenge to cover when it comes to the group stages. So I can't tell you what's going to be on there, but I can tell you that whatever we do will be good. And also, there's so much stuff that's actually been written over the last year, not just by me, but by everyone else, that if you felt like signing up and you haven't already, I genuinely promise you that there's probably more than you'll ever be able to read anyway. So
the sort of timeless stuff, the stuff that doesn't
loads of timeless stuff. I did a big thing on Phil Foden and in August, basically his kind of life story, I guess, it turned into a big thing on Sergio Aguero when he became the top overseas goalscorer back in January. Big interview with Stephen Ireland last September now, I guess. Loads of different things. Stuff on Guardiola and, stuff on City's tactics and why they do certain things or why they don't do certain things. Look, if you sign up now and you don't know where to start, send me a DM on Twitter or something like that and I'll send you some links.
Indeed, and for just £1 a month as well, still.
I can't like fake surprise anymore. They're still doing it. Obviously, they are still doing it, but fair play to them. And if anybody thinks, I'm not sure, like it's not going to get any cheaper than that. So just do it, and I'd like to be able to promise that you won't regret it.
Give it a go, because this offer is only running for a limited time only. So go to theathletic.com/mancitypod right now to sign up. That's theathletic.com/mancitypod, and it's just £1 a month. So I think the first question I've got, Sam, for you about the Arsenal game on Saturday, what part of it was more important? Getting the 3 points, keeping a clean sheet, or controlling the closing stages of the game when they were in front?
I suppose big picture was the control in the game. Because keeping a clean sheet, you know, the way Guardiola likes to do it is always by limiting them to few chances. So arguably, Arsenal could have scored and City could have still won, and that wouldn't have been the end of the world. 3 points is obviously important because what they City's 3 points behind Liverpool now, and they've got a game in hand, so that turned out to be not so bad. But I think big picture is just being able to control the game, not having one of those performances where City concede a stupid goal at any point, really, but particularly at the end. I saw a lot of tweets from fans going, oh, I know what's going to happen here, but it never really materialised in the end. It's hard to read too much into that game, because I don't think too many teams are going to play like that against City over the course of the season, and I don't think City are going to play in that kind of particular shape. But in terms of the fact that, well, we'll get into all the little bits, but yeah, the fact that they did manage to see the game out, and then the energy, the fact that there was no Laporte, no De Bruyne, but you wouldn't have strictly noticed. And the thing we've always said over the last few weeks, while we've said, look, they obviously need a midfielder or a left back or a striker or whatever, we have always said it would be good for this group of really talented players with Guardiola in charge to come up with something that doesn't just rely on, you know, new signings or, you know, De Bruyne to create five chances a game and the forward score two. And that's exactly what we got on Saturday. It was exactly the kind of performance you'd expect to see from City, I think, where, you know, if De Bruyne is not playing, well, fine, then Bernardo Silva will do really well. Or, you know, if Laporte's not playing, then there's somebody else to do the job and it's not all going to fall apart. So, yeah, it was, yeah, that little element of control in the game tied in with all those little things that were just kind of refreshing to see, I think.
I will say, watching the game, certainly in like midway through the second half, I wasn't feeling particularly comfortable. But then equally, when I take a step back from it and I look at what Arteta's done to Arsenal, Arsenal aren't the side that City usually roll over at this stage. Do you know what I mean? At that, when they're in front at that point, you know, the old Arsenal would fall apart. And so I kind of, maybe my unease at the way the game was going was a little bit premature about how good Arsenal actually were in comparison to what I expected them to be, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean. They're obviously a different beast under Arteta. I think some of the press were getting stuck into him a bit over the fact that I think he's played six games against top six teams and he's lost five of them. But I would like to say, in my opinion, they're clearly going in the right direction. As much as, you know, we're going to praise City's performance, a draw wouldn't have been out of the question, to be fair. It was that kind of game where you could, yeah, City did deserve what they got, but if it had been a draw, it wouldn't have, you know, it wouldn't have been unreasonable. And I suppose the threat with Arsenal is they kept, you know, trying to play out from the back and rob the ball in a certain way. And just, I think probably where the unease came from was, as kind of better a City were and good a City were, they did keep giving the ball away in the Arsenal half quite a bit. And quite often when that happens, the other team just turn around and sprint down the other end and they end up scoring. So the fact that City kept doing that, and with Arsenal's kind of pace and how they can get the ball forward quickly under Arteta, that was probably where the worry was coming from. But they either counter-press really well to stop those counter-attacks, or just defended properly. You know, like Diaz, obviously, whom I'm sure we'll come on to, was really good, but Walker was really, they were all really good. There were definitely those signs of, oh no. But I mean, if City can stop teams counter-attacking on them and scoring easily, then talking about big picture, you know, that would be very useful for the rest of the season.
Well, we'll come on to the defence shortly. First off, I want to kind of get into how City went about winning the game, because, the first 10 minutes were dominated by people going, what on earth is this shape and formation? Yeah, yeah. Until I think we all kind of settled on, well, we're never going to be able to describe this, so let's just go with it and see what happens. What was it like watching? Because obviously watching on the TV screen, as I was, you can't get the kind of big picture of how the movement happens and where players are going. What were they doing in that setup to basically control the game?
Christ. Just because I was in the stadium doesn't make me enough to understand it. What they were doing was, there was a times when, and look, you could put on different numbers depending on what was happening in the game, whether the City were pressing or whether they had the ball or whether they were defending. You know, it was a different shape. You know, at times they were 3-3-4, which was basically obviously copying Arsenal's broad 4-3-3, but it wasn't about numbers really. It wasn't even about positions. It was about roles and filling spaces and opening spaces. So Cancelo was at times a right back. Walker was at times a right back, but he was also a centre back.
It was very clever, that, to control Aubameyang, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I'll put this in my article, which, well, people will have hopefully read by now, but hasn't been published at time of of speaking. I think they were probably most impressed with Cancelo's performance at City because, from what I understand of last season, obviously Guardiola hinted that his attitude wasn't great, but he wasn't in the team, first of all, because of the adaptation. And part of the adaptation was that, you know, I think we know Cancelo is just a very kind of traditional fullback, get down the line and put a cross in. But at City, that's just not what you do, and especially at right back. You know, Walker's barely done that in his time at the club. So Cancelo had to get used to all these little tactical demands and having to do different things every game, and, you know, it was kind of struggling a bit. So the fact that he had to not just play right back, but kind of play right back sometimes, but also in midfield, not just like a bit of going in midfield, but be there quite a bit sometimes and still get forward to support the attack on the right and know when to do each different thing at the right moment. And I think they were impressed by the fact that he knew, you know, when he had to press Saka and when he had to cover Aubameyang. And it's one of those things where it reminds me of when City played Chelsea at Stamford Bridge when De Bruyne scored that goal in September 2017.
Yeah.
But it was the first game, I think, where they played with an inverted fullback. And after about 15 minutes, I remember going, what the hell's... like, where's Delph supposed to be there? And there was a massive space at City's left back. Well, Delph just got the wrong kind of, oh, I'm supposed to be here kind of thing. But after that, obviously, for the rest of the game and pretty much while he was at left back at City, he knew exactly where he needed to be. But you basically had to times that by 11 on Saturday because everyone was kind of fulfilling different roles. And if somebody had have got it wrong, it would have been really obvious. And look, there was a couple of times when Cancelo probably could have been a bit cleverer on the ball or, you know, just before half time, Arsenal got in down his side a couple of times. But in terms of, yeah, knowing where to be and when to be there, I thought he was really good. And yeah, how do they do it? I mean, it just depended on the different phases of play and on who had the ball and what Arsenal were doing and what City wanted to do. And I mean, a good example again, I mean, I couldn't tell you what triggered this, but the good example is in the build-up to the goal, Bernardo Silva was the left centre-back to get the ball off Edison. Obviously, he was dropping back inside alongside Rodri to make a bit of a double pivot to help City play out from the back. There's nothing revolutionary in that. City do that quite a lot. But yeah, sometimes, you know, he went to left centre-back and, you know, sometimes Ake was there, sometimes Ake was left-back. And the basic goal, you know, when they had the four across the front line was to stop Arsenal playing out from the back to cover off all those options and basically force them to go long. And then, you know, City would try and win the second balls. And obviously with Walker,
I was going to say, Walker's pace especially was good at that.
The pace, yeah, exactly. But also just in terms of winning headers and that kind of thing, you know, they were very well set up for that. So that's what they tried. And also, if you think about probably the other big chance that City had apart from the goal was when Aguero played in Foden and he kind of just got it under his feet a bit and Leno saved. That was from City covering off those options. I think they tried to play it into Saka and Cancelo was straight on him. And they worked it into Aguero and he found Foden. If they had scored that, it would have like illustrated perfectly what both teams were trying to do all game. But yeah, obviously City as well. Try and stop Arsenal playing out from the back, try and coax them into a pass into midfield and then pounce and go and score. Because Arsenal was so good at it, they didn't give City too many chances to do that and City didn't give Arsenal too many chances to do it either. That's why in the stadium it felt like a kind of really cagey, interesting game. But when I watched it back on Match of the Day, I was like, actually not a lot happened here, did it? But yeah, it was a really interesting one and that's how they did it.
I was going to say, in terms of just the way that the patterns of play in the game, I mean, is there any concern that City still couldn't quite finish it off? That the game was still alive going into those closing stages?
Yeah, in the sense that, the sharpness. You know, we talked about the Leeds game, and you know, Foden and Mahrez didn't play particularly well. They were better against Arsenal, but still not quite sharp enough. But you know, I think I asked Guardiola after the game what he was happy about the most, and he said the fact that they're still not ready to play 90 minutes at full throttle because they're not fit enough because they've not had the preparation, and even when they have had the preparation, you know, so many of the players have been injured or ill, so they're just not at that level. But he was so pleased that they were still able to do that. So you could tie that to the fact that maybe it's a case of sharpness for Foden and Mahrez, and Sterling as well. And obviously it is with Aguero, with him coming back from his injury. So it's like, as we've said before, when we were kind of clinging for reasons to be positive, I suppose, it was, well, once they are fit and once they are sharp, that will improve. So I think there was an element of that. But my only worry is, which was the same worry as when we were saying this in recent weeks, City were kind of fit enough and sharp enough and everybody was available apart from Aguero in July and August. But they still had those problems anyway. And they had the problems, you know, before lockdown last season anyway. So it's kind of like that the sharpness may be a thing, but at the end of the day, we all know Sterling is going to hesitate when he gets in the box and he's got time to think about what to do. You know, if he tries to go down the outside and he comes back inside, is he going to shoot or is he going to pass it? And that happened a few times. So some of it might be sharpness, but, you know, some of it might just be that thing we've seen with City over the last year or so where they kind of, I don't know, could get caught in two minds in front of the goal. So,
if Sterling whacks that one in at the near post in the second half, just after Bellerin he sat down before hand. It kills the game, and then we're not having this discussion. It's just that moment in front of goal, isn't it?
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I want to talk about Edison because obviously critical of him making the mistake at Leeds, despite the great saves that he made there. There were some cracking saves against Arsenal as well. The standout was in the first half with the top of his arm.
Yeah. And the weird one, because when you said the standout, it threw me a bit, just because they flagged Aubameyang offside, didn't they, eventually, once, which was the second of the one-on-one saves.
Yeah.
But if that had gone in, the goal would have stood because they would have checked it on VAR and he looked onside. So that was a really important one as well, but it seems to have got slightly lesser billing. But no, he was good. And yeah, but it was the same kind of situation as Leeds where I was like, well, he's done really well here. These are really good saves, but I'm not going to kind of tweet any praise about him until, you know, the final whistle, because as we saw with Leeds, and especially with goalkeepers, one little mistake and you're done. But no, he was great. His kicking, it wasn't like one of those performances where it made the difference. But that's the thing with City, and compared to Arsenal as well, is when Arsenal kind of pinned City in and made sure they couldn't go short, Edison's just so good at dropping balls into midfield or even going long.
There was a couple of times where he was under pressure and he kind of almost faked the pass, and whoever was chasing him down slowed down, and it was enough just to get whoever he was going to pass it to be able to get a yard of space. It's just like that ability that, I mean, you watched it at the other end, Leno wasn't doing that, and that again, marginal gains, was a very small difference between the teams.
Yeah, and that's a really good example, because it goes to show as well that it's not just kind of the accuracy or the technique on his kicks, but it's just, it's those little, you know, tiny things that make the difference, actually. It's not just all about the actual execution of the kick itself, but how he makes that space for himself. It actually reminded me a bit of, you know, when Cancelo did that low cross in the second half, when David Luiz nearly put it in for an own goal.
Yeah.
The beauty of that trick that Cancelo did was he actually shaped to do a cross with the outside of his right foot. And the guy marking him obviously thought, oh, I've seen this before. And he fully committed to it. But then he quickly shifted it back with his left foot onto his right and he put it back in. And just, I've never seen that kind of dummy before where you think, oh, well, this guy's only got a right foot, so he's going to do it with the outside of his right. And then he dummied it and still used his right anyway, but it managed to make it work. That was really clever. It's a bit like that with Edison. It's just that little dummy, that little kind of trick that just gives you that extra, like, second is all you need to get the ball exactly where you want it to go. And that goes to show why again, I keep going back to what Sean Dyche said about Edison a couple of years ago, but it's like having Ronald Koeman in goal. You know, he's not just a goalkeeper who's a good kicker. He understands these things as well as an outfield player does.
Yeah. I'm going to touch on Diaz as well because, I mean, he was great for a second game running. He obviously gets his first clean sheet as a City player now. He seemed to find the ability to just get his head on everything that was coming into that box. And not only that, the one thing that kind of struck me, I was watching without crowd noise, and you could hear him like quite vocally telling teammates what to do. Yeah. For a player as young and in his second game, that's only a good sign as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, well, that was one of the things that shone through when we did a feature on him, you know, what he brings to City. It was that leadership. And, you know, a lot of the people who know him at Benfica were like, oh, yeah, well, you know, he's really vocal and he'll do this to City. It's like, well, he's 23, he's coming to a new country. And obviously, like when we were putting it through the spin of, well, you know, they've not had this since Kompany. No one's going to be Kompany. They could have bought Sergio Ramos and he wouldn't be Kompany because of what he means to the club. But it's like, well, he's obviously going to need time to adapt. But in the same kind of way that Eric Garcia was doing it when he was 17 years old, like some players just have that maturity. But obviously, Diaz combines that maturity with, you know, he's a lot more louder and shoutier than Garcia is, for example. You know, Garcia's more of an organiser and, I don't know, Diaz is a bit more of a bollocker. You know, still organising, yeah. But he bollocks them as well. And, yeah, I mean, I think teams need that. Teams need a bit of that. That back line needs a bit of that. Again, I made the point in my article. If you run through all the City centre-back options last season, Fernandinho, Garcia, Stones and Otamendi, and even Rodri, actually, you could say they'd all be all right, or they'd all be better there if Laporte was there as well. But with, you know, everyone talks about the money City have spent on centre-backs, but regardless, you can't have like four or five centre-backs options and just hope that they're all good when the good guy's playing. You might as well play me there. Like, what they actually need is somebody to just be good. And it's really early days, but if Diaz is that, and he was that against Arsenal, then great, because it means that they're not just relying on Laporte, and all of a sudden when Laporte wasn't on the team sheet, everyone's like, oh god, here we go again. But if Diaz can just stand up and, you know, if he can take control of it, then great. And then, you know, if Laporte comes back soon, or whenever they're both back as a partnership, it's pretty promising. And obviously Ake as well.
I was going to say, let's not forget Ake in this, because he was good. He had a real good game.
Yeah, I think like Rodri as well, Rodri did too. And in fact, I saw a stat that he win the ball back in the Arsenal half 11 times, which is like more than anybody else has done this season for any team, apparently. My take on that for both of them is it was one of those performances where the whole system worked and everybody was kind of, it wasn't like fully energetic and full press for the whole game, as we know, because of the fitness issues and that kind of stuff. But it was one of those where everybody kind of did their job, and the forwards and the midfielders and the defenders, they all kind of helped each other. So Ake was less exposed and Rodri was less exposed. And for that reason, it was easier for them to kind of hold it together, because, you know, we know that's been the issue with, you know, Rodri's just looked up and he's had two men breaking past him because, you know, somebody's not done their job further up the pitch. But that wasn't the case. And then the easier it was for Rodri to deal with things, the easier it was for Ake to deal with things, and that kind of like reverse domino effect. So, yeah Ake was really solid as well. It's just, it's one of those. It wasn't just that Diaz was much better than Ake because Ake was poor. Just Diaz was just stood out in a really obvious way, because it was a typical commanding centre-back performance. And I suppose what stands out about that is the fact that City haven't had too many of those.
Yeah, just on the leadership thing as well, it's a different type of leadership as well, isn't it, that he has than Laporte? Because I don't think of Laporte as someone who is necessarily a massive talker.
No. No. No, he's not really. And I don't think anybody would disagree with that, really. It's just the kind of... It's just the fact that he's there and he does everything. You know, he wins headers and he's quick enough once he gets going to mop up in behind. He's dealt with a lot of counter attacks in his time, just with that ability really to get back and make a tackle. Obviously, his passing out from the back, left foot and right foot, is really good, and he switches the play, and that's why, you know, City just look better with him in the team, because he's much more dependable. But no, he's not. He's not a big voice on the pitch. I don't think he's a particularly big voice in the changing room either. He's just a kind of quiet, simple guy, really.
Yeah, which, sort of unassuming.
Yeah, exactly. But City got about 15 of them. So yeah. I think you do need a few more Diazes.
Yeah. Just while we're on the defence, you were having a bit of fun with this on Twitter at halftime. Kyle Walker, potential penalty incident. Any surprise that that wasn't looked at?
Well, surprised that it wasn't looked at in the sense that people were saying VAR didn't even bother checking. So I thought they just had to check everything. That's just the point of it. Like, why would you, if you decided, oh, well, we're not going to check that because the ref will have seen it. It's like, well, how do you know he's seen it? Or like, even if the ref's gone, oh yeah, I saw that and there was nothing in it. That the whole point of having VAR is sometimes the ref doesn't see what he thinks he's seen. So very surprised if they didn't check it. I mean, they must have. But I didn't think it was a penalty. I thought it would have been harsh. Like, it's one of those where his foot was up, but we know in football, you know, you can say, oh, well, anywhere else on the pitch, it would have been a free kick. And yeah, but we know in football that that's not the case.
I don't want to be Mr. kind of anorak here, but anywhere else on the pitch, and I think that's an indirect free kick. So I'm not having penalty for that. high foot dangerous play is unless you make contact with the head, it's not a direct incident. So I'm not having a penalty.
I'm just trying to think, because there was one in the Merseyside derby. Was it Gomez and Mane? And he didn't actually make contact, but Mane went down anyway. And I'm sure
they gave a direct free kick.
Yeah, they did.
It's one of my biggest gripes about things like Football Manager, where they say, oh, he obstructed him in the box, penalty. It's like, the obstruction's not a direct free kick offence, but I don't want to be that guy, but you know.
Okay, well, that actually ties into the fact that when Bernardo was trying to chase down Leno yesterday and Gabriel stepped across him, that wouldn't have been a penalty either.
It should have been a free kick probably, but I the day we see an indirect free kick in the box that is not for a goalkeeper picking up a pass back I don't think we'll ever see it again, you know.
No, I didn't think it was a penalty. Like, there's so many incidents I just look at and I just can't make my mind up. Like, not really sure, but like, I didn't really think that was a pen. No, not above my personal threshold, personally.
Right, so let's talk Aguero, because a little bit of a surprise to see him starting.
I thought he'd play. Partly because they've not had anybody to like be that proper number nine, and it's not worked brilliantly without one. And also the fact that he's been like kind of raring to go for a few weeks, but they've wanted to get him back up to like match fitness. I thought it'd start. When people asked on the Q&A and on Twitter, my guess was that he would. I didn't think he'd play the full 90 minutes, but it just felt like one of those games where if I'd have been another team, a team that Guardiola didn't respect as highly as he does an Arteta team, he might not have tried it. But yeah, I wasn't surprised, because he's been raring to go. And also he was posting, did he post like a social media video saying like, I'm back, which was a nice big clue as well. So and again, so was Sterling doing like the Premier League interview before the game. I was like, well, he's going to start as well then.
Yeah, in terms of Aguero and his movement and that sort of thing, because this, I mean, we've been talking in the past about this being an injury that is, a meniscus injury is difficult to come back from. The signs looked pretty good that he was able to move and link up play just like the old Aguero could.
I think the thing with the meniscus knee injury isn't so much that it kind of affects your on-pitch performance once you've recovered, but you might just get a setback later on. I mean, maybe it wasn't dealt with, or it's not as severe as Mendy's was, or maybe it was, and we'll see that if he has a little bit of inflammation or swelling in a couple of weeks or something. I'm not sure, but in terms of the sharpness and the understanding of the role, I suppose, Aguero's Aguero, really. He's never going to lose that kind of goal scorer's instinct, but obviously since everything he added on to that since Guardiola came, he won't have forgotten either. It was good. And I suppose the worry might be that there would be some kind of ill effects from the knee injury, but that doesn't seem to have been the case. He seems happy enough going off.
Nice touch when he went off as well. Exactly.
I mean, it was a solid enough performance. Definitely. But like, in the same way that the other forwards weren't quite sharp enough, you could maybe see that with him, but completely understandable.
Yeah, quick word on the incident with Sean Marcialis and, and Aguero, because I mean, like, if reading some of the reports today, you know, if you'd not seen the incident, you'd have been you could have seen Darth Vader picking up that rebel troop at the start of Star Wars. But it feels like something that he probably shouldn't have done. He probably should apologise for, but that's it, really.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit uncomfortable. Like, when I first saw it, I was a bit like, don't touch her, mate. Like, just don't touch women that don't want to be touched. And, you know, you go down all kinds of different wormholes of, oh, you know, well, what's different to him touching
a male assistant
or a male referee or whatever. It's just like, look, there's just different contexts, and women don't want to be touched by men while they're doing their job. It's just like any blanket touching. Just, you know, it wasn't sexual harassment, was it? But it was just that kind, just even that kind of, for me, it just felt a bit like that everyday sexism where, like, I'm sure Aguero personally was probably just feeling, oh, well, you know, it's nothing, or it's just that idea where you just wouldn't want to be in that position. You just wouldn't.
Yeah.
Well, you just get your hands off me kind of thing. Like you say, uncomfortable. Shouldn't have done it.
But I probably should have been booked for it, and that's about it, really.
I don't know, because the thing is, I think I've read today that, you know, there is no rule about touching officials unless it's like aggressive. So in terms of in the rules, I don't think he should have been booked for it. I just think it's the wider context of men touching women in a way that they don't want to be touched, and like if it's just like a little. Because, again, like you say, it wasn't like a big Darth Vader death grip, but it was just a kind of a touch on the shoulder. They're just like, what are you doing? Get off me. Like, it was that kind of thing. So, yeah, I don't think it's like a footballing issue in terms of one that they could book him for. I don't think that's in the rules.
Yeah.
And there's no rule for if there's a woman running the line, don't touch her. It's just a social thing. But, again, why you've got this conflict is because, you know, if you look at Twitter, there'll be a lot of people who are saying it's not an issue. It'll be men and women, but you've got a lot of people who actually think it's much worse than I do. You know, I think it was uncomfortable and he shouldn't have done it. But there's a lot of people who would say it's much worse. You know, there's a tweet saying it's like gross and completely unacceptable. I mean, I wouldn't personally go that far. It's not something I'd do. And like I say, he shouldn't have done it. But like you said, basically, if he were to apologise, I think that would be about right. I mean, to be honest, I feel like now I'm waffling on too much. We're also making it a huge thing, because, like I said, I don't think it was a huge like ban him for one game issue. It's probably a helpful conversation though.
Yeah.
Like anything in football, if you have it in good faith, because if you've just got two sides and one says this is the worst thing that's ever happened,
he should be banned. I'm an Arsenal fan. I'm a United fan. Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, but not even that. I mean, there's just from a kind of, you know, from women who feel that's wholly unacceptable. You know, that's also that's at least more honest than a fan of a rival club saying banning. But at the same time, if you've got a load of people saying, "Oh, there's nothing," you know, get on with it. It's not. It doesn't always feel like a useful conversation at the time. It feels kind of futile, but I think it helps. It helps kind of move the conversation forward, and it helps, you know, maybe people realize, you know, maybe some of the people are saying there's nothing in it. Maybe put their arm around women in the same way and think they're being friendly, and the women actually think, I don't like this. What are you doing? And it will help some people realize. You just got to be a bit more careful these days, and that's how these things always seem to go.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com /courtside to learn more.
Well, let's touch on a couple of the other injuries as well, because I mean, it's a week after we had the discussion about Omar Berada's comments about Benjamin Mendy. Lo and behold, not fit and available.
Funny that. Yeah. But I mean, what else needs to be said? We said at the time, didn't we?
Is there any news on how bad it is?
3 to 4 weeks, I think Guardiola said, for Mendy. I think it's a groin. So yeah, I mean, not entirely related to.
Well, at least it's a new one. Yeah,
yeah, I suppose. Yeah. So yeah, 3 to 4 weeks. But at the same time, especially how, you know, I don't think City are going to play that formation every week, so it doesn't really matter that Ake played in that particular way. But I think, given the way that City covered quite admirably, and the fact that Mendy's last game wasn't particularly good, I don't think too many City fans would be kind of crossing their fingers and hoping for him to be back ASAP.
How about Laporte? Because you said before about getting nervous when Laporte wasn't in the 18, and you can understand why. Guardiola said it was a small problem. Any idea kind of whether that's, oh, he'll be fit for Porto, or whether it's kind of a couple of weeks sort of thing?
I think that's what I've heard is 2 to 3 weeks, and that's groin as well, apparently. So, I mean, 2 to 3 weeks. I mean, isn't Liverpool quite soon?
Yeah, I mean, 2 to 3 weeks in this current climate could be like 4 or 5 games. Yeah,
And Liverpool soon as well. But yeah, I mean, yeah, and you never know with City and their injuries. You know, Guardiola said Aguero will be out 1 or 2 months, didn't he? And that was the 18th of September. He said that, and he played at the weekend. So, it's like, it's always funny when, you know, when he said De Bruyne wouldn't play, loads of people were like, "Ah, stupid mind games. Of course he will." It's like, you've not been paying attention at all. If he says somebody's out, like 99 times out of 100, they're going to be out. But when he says, "Oh yeah, everyone's all right, no problems," you can almost guarantee
there's somebody not available.
At least one player is not going to be playing. And yeah, so like whenever he says that in future now, I just wouldn't read anything into it whatsoever, because, I mean, unless Laporte and Mendy both got injured on Saturday, and I don't know. He must have known that they were going to be out. So yeah, that's a funny one.
Jesus may be a worry though, because
a weird one.
The news on this one, he wasn't very specific, was he?
No, and also my little roundup there of 2 to 3 weeks. They weren't sure on what on what's going on with Jesus. So yeah, Guardiola's kind of vague, but he said they had to be careful because it's one of those where. He said it's a delicate muscle in the front of his leg, and if he were to be rushed back, he could go again and he'd be out for a long time. And I mean, I'm not sure what kind of really bad muscle injury you could get that would mean you out for like a month or two. But I mean, it doesn't sound suspicious to me. It just sounds like a potentially tricky one. And I think it's similar with De Bruyne in the fact that he's not injured. De Bruyne, I don't think. So it's different to Jesus in that sense, but he's basically in the red zone. And if he had have played, he could have got injured. And obviously, if he then gets injured, he's going to miss a few games. But the only thing is, like you say, with so many games now, if they're resting him, you know, to kind of get rid of that muscle fatigue, even if that's 7 to 10 days, he'll probably miss 3 matches.
Yeah, but they'll also need to rest other players to stop that happening to them, I guess, as well.
Yeah. But that, again, that comes back to kind of the beauty of the game. If all of City's squad players are actually going to contribute to good team performances in kind of crazy Guardiola mega mind tactics, then great. Like, if it means that, you know, Gundogan can slot in for Rodri, or even Bernardo in a way, I know, very different type, the way, you know, they cover the pitch is very different, but, you know, if you could have a midfield of Gundogan, Rodri and Fernandinho that would actually give a team a result rather than just looking completely short of ideas, then great, because they're, you know, good, expensive players, and you expect that. So yeah, hopefully from City's point of view, if they could do that against Arsenal, the hope is that they could get, you know, that supporting cast, you know, the likes of Bernardo and, I don't know, well, basically anyone who's not a star name to actually contribute to a good performance, then it should bode well. But the only kind of thing there is, like I say, earlier on. They're not going to play against Arsenal very often, and they're not going to do that very often, and they're going to have to find those solutions. Those kind of players are going to have to find solutions against teams that just sit back and deny the spaces, and you know that's very hard to play against, that we know from the last 12 months that City have struggled with that.
The one thing that the injuries did do for the Arsenal game is it almost was like the stepping stone to return to a 2018-19 Bernardo Silva. I thought his performance was very much a Bernardo Silva on good form again.
Yeah, it was like that. Guardiola kind of said, generally speaking, after the game, you know, the win is obviously good for their confidence, and you know, winning helps you win more games. I guess with Bernardo, the combination of tiredness and kind of lack of confidence last season is he probably needed a performance like that. And also the other thing is, apart from how last season went. And whether, you know, he can do what he did against Arsenal more often is, in that 2018-19 season, obviously he was often very good on the right-hand side, but a lot of his good performances came in that De Bruyne role. And we know, because I've banged on about it ever since I found out, that, you know, the difference between De Bruyne's role and the David Silva role. And, you know, Guardiola doesn't see Bernardo as a similar player to David Silva, and that's why he very rarely played as number eight, because De Bruyne was, you know, mostly fit last season. But now with De Bruyne out, it provides an opportunity for Bernardo to, you know, to keep doing what he did on Saturday in the next couple of games if De Bruyne is going to be rested again or kept back again. And then, yeah, if they're both fit, they're going to have to kind of work something out. But what Guardiola did do on Saturday and what the squad did do was work something out anyway, to, you know, a midfield without Fernandinho, without David Silva, without De Bruyne. Which, you know, if that had happened last season, you'd have been thinking, well, they're not going to win this. They found a way to do it. So yeah, hopefully Bernardo, with his versatility, and Guardiola, if he's coming up with new ideas and new balances to the midfield and new ways of doing things, and hopefully there is a way to fit both of them in after all. Even, you know, it's probably going to mean a double pivot and Bernardo and De Bruyne, as I've mentioned before. But yeah, if there's a space for Bernardo and he plays like he did a couple of years ago or 18 months ago, then you know that's obviously another huge boost.
Yeah, perfect. Crack on. I want to finish the very final part of today's show, and this is a bit of a gear change, but you know we'll go with it. Pablo Zabaleta's retired this week. You didn't really get to see peak Zabaleta in your time covering City, did you?
No, no. My first season was Pellegrini's last.
And he was waning, but he's definitely waning by then.
Yeah, and then obviously his last season was Guardiola's first season, and that was a struggle. You know, obviously it was a struggle for everyone, but kind of particularly for him. But I mean, I don't think there's anything I can add that City fans don't know already in terms of his performance. I did write quite a nice article about him when he left City, so people could go and Google that, I suppose.
But did you get to speak to him much?
Yeah, but that's what I was going to say. Like, from the media perspective, maybe people don't care about media in general, and rightly so. But to be fair, I think fans would be happy to know that he is a nice bloke. And yeah, he would always be one of those few players that he'd be happy to do an interview, and he'd always talk quite well and quite openly, and you know, say, you know, he wasn't explosive, he wasn't a dynamite, but what he would say would be interesting, and it wasn't dull. And yeah, he was always just nice, friendly, and just seemed like a great guy. And obviously, he was really popular with his teammates. If ever you'd see them interact, just in mix zones or wherever else it might be. So yeah, the only other thing I'd add, because everybody knows how good he was, and everybody loves him already, is the fact that, you know, I never saw anything really behind the scenes to make me think, you know, because there's a few players. This is a bit of a rabbit hole. There's a few players City fans love that you'd be like, well, you know, if you've heard what I've heard, kind of thing, which I'm not going to go into. You can leave it at that.
But no, Zabaleta,
yeah, but Zabaleta wasn't one of those.
Yeah. Do you see a potential role for him at City now that he's retired?
Well, City are good at that. I feel like it's a bit of a shame, actually, because I read an interview with Zabaleta recently. And he was saying he's always planned to go and play a couple of years in Italy at the end of his career, but he was kind of like, well, what's the point now? Because, you know, he'd always planned on going to play in the great stadiums, but with no fans, he was thinking like, well, there might not be any point. And obviously, ultimately, that is what he's decided. I mean,
that makes me feel really sad now.
Yeah, I mean, he might not have had any offers anyway, but he But yeah, he's obviously just went, well, yeah, that's, there's no point in doing that, and let's retire. And I mean, if he's going to stay in the UK, I think he had to kind of convince his wife to say, look, I'm going to stay in England. We'll have a couple of years in London and then we'll go back to Europe. So I'm not sure what that family situation is. Maybe they're thinking now, you know, maybe they'll go and live in Italy, or maybe they'll move back to, you know, Barcelona, having been Espanol or whatever. But if he's sticking around in England, you'd like to think there'd definitely be something for him to say. But the only thing is, it's just quite difficult. You know, Guardiola's coaching staff is pretty hard to get onto. You can't just add people onto that. You know, maybe jobs in the academy, but since Vieira, that's not happened. And then, yeah, I don't know, like maybe a club ambassador of sorts, but I wonder how many club ambassador roles are actually going on at the moment, because people aren't generally going out and meeting people.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't know what it would be, but City are good at keeping people involved. I don't know, maybe they'd kind of have a word with him and see if he'd go and speak in the media. I know Micah Richards has kind of got that nailed down at the moment, and to be honest, you'd have to be a very good pundit, certainly very charismatic, to get on instead of him. But I know City are always keen to have
more
City voices on, you know, Sky and wherever. So I mean, maybe they'd kind of use him indirectly in that kind of role. But yeah, I'm sure they'll find a way to keep him in touch. And I suppose the other thing is, they've got enough clubs around where, you know, they could do it. He could do something in the CFG in some capacity, but I suppose it depends on where he wants to live and how he wants to live his life at the moment.
Yeah, and he's ever since he moved to Europe, he's only ever played for teams that play in converted athletic stadiums. Bet you didn't know that. Espanyol, oh. City, West Ham.
All right. Well, maybe there's... In fact, you've actually stumped me with that. that's just such like a mundane but quite funny stat. I've got absolutely nothing to. I thought you were just going to say blue and white, but obviously I forgot about West Ham. So converted athletic stadiums. Yeah, I mean, have you read that somewhere else, or did you just?
I've got to give credit to Duncan Alexander from Opta for that one.
Oh God, yeah. That makes complete sense. Now.
I think, given your reaction to that, I'm going to end the show there because it's only downhill from there, really, isn't it? So that's it for this week's Why Always Us. You've been listening to Sam Lee.
Yeah, thanks very much.
And to me, David Mooney. Don't forget, you can sign up to The Athletic for just £1 right now by using the code MANCITYPOD.